Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address from the Protectors of Freedom Rally, presented by Patriotic Productions, an Omaha nonprofit that has sponsored the honor flights to Washington, D.C., for veterans of World War II and Korea. The featured speaker will be the Sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, David Clark. Sheriff Clark has been Milwaukee County's sheriff since 2002. He has strongly supported police officers in the current discussion over the police killings of Eric Garner in New York City and Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Sheriff Clark, a Democrat and an African American, has been a sharp critic of President Barack Obama, Attorney General Eric Holder, and MSNBC commentator Al Sharpton for what he described as fanning the flames of racial discord with their comments after the incidents. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 15, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Patriotic Productions, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to begin the program is co-founder with his wife Yvonne of Patriotic Productions, Bill Williams.
It is my pleasure to introduce our master of ceremonies this evening. This is quite a get for Yvonne and I. Chris Peranto has led a dangerous life, to say the least. First as an Army Ranger, then as a security contractor for Blackwater and the U.S. Government Global Response Staff. It was the latter role that would lead him to be in Benghazi, Libya, at the time of the infamous terror attack on September 11, 2012, helping to save over 20 lives while fighting off terrorists from the CIA annex for over 13 hours. Most people don't know he lives right here in Omaha. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Chris Peranto.
Thank you. I do appreciate it. I don't feel like I deserve any of this, honestly. But it does help getting the support, especially since we still need to get the truth out, which we're trying to do. But again, I don't want to get off on a tangent because this isn't about Benghazi tonight. It's about supporting the linguists that we've had and also hearing a great speaker speak tonight. So I know I've been on Fox. In fact, we've passed each other in the hallway there at Fox a couple times with, we haven't even noticed it before. So Sheriff David Clark is joining us tonight, and it's an honor for me to introduce him. Now, Sheriff, I don't know your whole bio, so I'm going to be reading it off here, no disrespect at all. But, Sheriff David Clark joining us today from Milwaukee County. Sheriff Clark is a lifelong resident of the city of Milwaukee, graduate of Marquette University High School, and a summa cum laude graduate of Concordia University, Wisconsin. I hated college, so that is impressive to me. That's fantastic. In 2013, he completed a rigorous 18-month master's degree and thesis program, earning an MA in Security Studies from the Naval Postgraduate School, Center for Homeland Defense and Security in Monterey, California. And as a postgraduate student, Sheriff Clark collaborated with national officials on current policy, strategy, organizational design, challenges in security studies, homeland security, and defense. Very good. Sheriff Clark was recognized with the 2013 Sheriff of the Year Award from the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association for demonstrating true leadership and courage, staying true to his oath, true to his badge, and true to the people he promised to serve and protect, which is very admirable. Thank you. The sheriff's 35 years as a law enforcement professional began at the Milwaukee Police Department in 1978. Where he served 24 distinguished years. His broad base of experience included duty as a patrol officer and detective and extensive service in the city's specialized homicide division. Following promotion to the captain of police, he commanded both the intelligence division and the downtown first district. Did I get that right? Perfect. In March 2002, he was appointed Milwaukee County Sheriff by Governor Scott McCallum. And in November 2002, he was elected to his first four-year term, ending 64% of the vote, which is outstanding. He was reelected in November 2006 2010 and 2014, increasing his margin of victory to 73%, 74%, and 79% respectively, which means he was doing an outstanding job. Sheriff Clark is a graduate of the FBI National Academy and the FBI National Executive Institute, both in Quantico, Virginia. He completed the program for senior executives in state and local government and the Driving Government Performance Executive Education Program at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. If I got any of that wrong, don't throw the cuffs on me. I'm trying. I'm keeping up on it. You've done a lot of stuff. I hope I can accomplish half of this. He and his wife, Julia, reside in Milwaukee currently. Following his presentation, Sheriff Clark will take questions for 15 minutes, and we'll try to facilitate that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor, and please give a big round of applause to introduce David A. Clark, the Sheriff of Milwaukee County.
I tried to hit everything I could, sir. I tried to get everything.
That's good.
I appreciate you. We're on the same team. Thanks for speaking out.
Thanks.
This is a good man.
Can you do me a favor?
Of course.
Wow. What a sincere pleasure to be here in Omaha, Nebraska, and I sincerely mean that. This is a piece of Americana. It really is. And the people are what make Omaha, Nebraska. All right, I'm a Midwesterner myself, grew up in the Midwest, Wisconsin, from an urban county, but love rural areas. Most of the state of Wisconsin is rural, by the way. I'm a horseman, own my own horse, spend a lot of time working with equines. I love it. First, I want to thank the veterans in the audience here. I never pass a veteran without thanking him or her for their service to our country. They are what make everything possible. All right, they are the defenders of freedom from foreign threats and foreign invasions. My father is a Korean War veteran, airborne ranger, had numerous combat jumps. He gave me my stake in America. All right, my father served in the U.S. military when the military was segregated. He had to serve in an all-black unit of airborne rangers, but you know what? He knew that this country at some point would live up to the true meaning of its creed, as Dr. Martin Luther King so eloquently said, and he knew that one day his children would be able to go on and reach their God-given potential in a better country than it was back then. He had a reason to have a chip on his shoulder, having to serve in a segregated army, and he didn't. And he raised his kids that way. So as I said, he gave me my stake in America and expected me to go out and take advantage of all this great country has to offer. And that's what I did, and that's what I do every day. But I'm here for a different reason tonight. Thank you all for coming, first of all. I'm here because this honorable profession that I have dedicated 37 years of my life to is under siege. It's under siege from a group of cop-hating anarchists who have been given a pathway to come above board and to start to exhibit that hatred toward our community's finest. And I stood up here after the tragic incident in Ferguson, Missouri, and watched as some prominent Americans occupying some of the highest offices in this land, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, Governor Nixon of Missouri, Senator, United States Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Mayor Bill de Blasio, trash and slander your community's finest. And there was no opportunity for them to fight back. I stood up and listened to Barack Obama say that police officers have a fear of people that don't look like them. And I've never been more disgusted in a statement uttered by a president of the United States in its history. And I stood up and listened to Eric Holder accuse law enforcement officers with a very broad brush of being racist, bloodthirsty, and summarily executing young black males as if it were some sort of sport. And Eric Holder likes to walk around talking about his brother as a retired police officer. And every time I hear him say that, I say to myself, I'm glad I'm not your brother. And then I heard Mayor Bill de Blasio, the mayor of the, arguably anyway, the landmark city in the United States of America, New York, throw his entire police department under the bus for cheap political purposes. Mayor de Blasio said that the grand jury refusal to indict the officers in the Eric Garner death, a tragedy, by the way, that was a remnant of slavery. And as I listen to these men, I ask myself, is this 2014 or 1814? Let me talk about race just for a second here. I only get 15 minutes. But I did have one gentleman say, if you want to turn that 15 minutes into 15 years, you go ahead. I may just turn it into 15 hours. I don't think I need 15 years. But we are in a hotel, so we can take a break, go get a nap, and come on back. Slavery left an ugly wound in the soul of this nation. We all know that. But that wound has been trying to heal. And there are people in this country who do not want that wound to heal, and they continually pick at it, rub sandpaper over it, in hopes of keeping it festering. I am living proof that anybody in America who's willing to work hard with self-discipline, with self-determination, with self-actualization, with the ability to overcome obstacles, if you fall down, you get back up. Those are the virtues that my mom and dad instilled in me. They knew this would be an unfair world at times. But their attitude was, son, you're going to have to be doubly prepared to deal with it. They didn't teach me to harbor any ill will toward white society. It wasn't necessary. So, a long time ago, I made my peace with America. And I forgave America for the ugly sin of slavery. I didn't say I forgot. I said I forgave. Because the God that I pray to every day teaches me to forgive. The God that I pray to every day sent the Son who hung on a cross. And in his final moments, looked up toward the sky and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus could do that, then I can forgive. But there's another reason that I forgave America for the ugly sin of slavery. because I knew that if I was going to go on and participate in everything that America had to offer and reach my full potential, I could not do it with this emotional baggage of thinking that racism lurks around every corner and that that boogeyman of racism was right over my shoulder, because I knew it wasn't true. Are we a perfect nation? Of course not. Does racism still exist? Probably. But it's been driven underground. And it's episodic. It is not institutional, like I heard Barack Obama utter in an interview during this whole Ferguson, Missouri tragedy, that racism is still institutional in the United States of America. That is a lie. So I let it go. Now, I expect race hustlers like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and others to do what they do. That's who they are. I do not expect my president, I do not expect my attorney general, I do not expect the mayor of New York to act like the vulgar human being that Al Sharpton is, and to keep company with him, by the way. You've all heard that Al Sharpton has been to the White House about 84 times. And I have to question the judgment of anybody who would hold counsel, keep company with, or take advice from Al Sharpton. So let's go back quickly over the Ferguson, Missouri. We've all heard about it. It was front and center on the news for a very long time. A tragedy. Mike Brown did not need to die at the hands of a law enforcement officer. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Brown was a co-conspirator in his own death. Mike Brown, like too many young black males in the United States, growing up without a role model, without a father figure in his life like I had, never learned respect for authority. He never learned respect for himself. I'm not here to stand in judgment of Mike Brown, but I am here to deal with reality. Mike Brown just came out of a convenience store where he bullied a store clerk half his size and stole something. That doesn't mean he deserved to die. But he carried that chip on his shoulders out of that store. And when he came across an authority figure that he did not learn how to respect, and I don't mean as a police officer, I'm talking about an authority figure. And Darren Wilson wasn't going to back down because he couldn't. He has a duty and an obligation to take proper action. So Mike Brown, if you read the evidence of what happened after the grand jury released its finding, attacked Darren Wilson. Mike Brown tried to disarm Officer Darren Wilson. And Darren Wilson was forced. And ladies and gentlemen, I say forced because no law enforcement officer in the United States puts on that uniform and that badge every day and goes out into the community looking to summarily execute somebody. Was forced to do what he did to protect his own life. And I watched as the race hustlers converged on Ferguson, Missouri, and exploited that situation to try to reopen that wound of racism in America. This movement was hijacked by this current movement today, like in Boston, was hijacked by anarchists, by the Occupy crowd, for their own personal agenda. This movement is not about civil rights. This movement is not about police use of force. This movement is not about racism in America. It is a socialist movement. So then the riots ensued. And I heard the President of the United States stand up and say, we need to understand their anger. And I said to myself, no, I do not understand rioting and looting. I understand frustration, but there is a socially acceptable way to deal with frustration, and it is not rioting and looting. So, Ferguson, Missouri was turned upside down. And when the people that converged on Ferguson, Missouri, like vultures on a roadside carcass, then they left. And left the good people, the overwhelming majority of good people in Ferguson, Missouri, to sift through the rubble and try to put their lives back together. Nowhere were these vultures to be found, including Al Sharpton. So then the grand jury rendered their decision. Now, ladies and gentlemen, our system of justice is not broken, like many have suggested after the Ferguson, Missouri incident. Our system of justice is imperfect, but it's imperfect because it's run by human beings, and human beings are imperfect. But it is grounded in the rule of law. And that's the standard that we have to judge these things by, not by emotion, not by some arbitrary demand by a mob of people to hang some police officer in retribution. This is a witch hunt. Now let's go to New York. Eric Garner, a little more problematic. Was not about race. Police use of force, yeah, maybe. But keep in mind, Eric Garner was also a co-conspirator in his own death. Because whether you like it or not, if our democratic state is going to survive, it has to be based on the rule of law. And the rule of law must prevail. And in this country, you have a duty, and an obligation to comply with an officer's lawful commands. I don't care whether you like it or not. I don't care whether this officer was overbearing, because sometimes they are. But we deal with that later. You are not going to win that argument on the street. So these officers, and we can question, why are some of New York's finest being sent on an assignment, which is really a tax collection initiative? Loose cigarettes, failure to have a tax stamp on the cigarettes he was selling. But Eric Garner, again, he didn't deserve to die, but he's a street hustler. Doesn't make him the worst guy in the world. But I'm not going to stand up and have these people talk about Mike Brown and Eric Garner as if it's Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm not going to stand for it. These are not icons in the civil rights movement. One chose thug life, and the other was a street hustler. Rosa Parks wasn't a street hustler. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't a thug. But that's what we're left with. You know what that's an indication to me of? We've gotten better as a nation. That they can't find legitimate truly legitimate icons in the civil rights movement, that they got to go out and wrap themselves around criminals and say, this is the face of injustice in America. No, it's not. So the grand jury returns its verdict in New York, made their finding. And then we get this, I can't breathe. You know why we can't breathe as a people, black people? Because of failed liberal government policies that have given rise to the welfare state. The welfare state has its boot on our neck. That's why we can't breathe. This is the discussion I want to have, because I've been hearing that a lot. We need to have a discussion on race, and I said, I'll get it started. Why do we have a permanent underclass, a growing permanent underclass, in the United States of America, the most advanced industrialized nation of the world? A permanent underclass, where people have been sentenced to living life at the bottom. That's why I said, this isn't about police use of force. Let's talk about why we won't end these oppressive welfare policies that destroy motivation, make people dependent on the government instead of standing on their own 2 feet, working hard, staying disciplined, failing, yeah. Because anybody that's succeeded in life, as you know, has failed a number of times, including me. But my parents instilled in me the virtue of being able to overcome obstacles. Get up, my dad would say. Stop feeling sorry for yourself and get back in there and fight. Mike Brown didn't have somebody to tell him that. Eric Garner didn't have somebody to tell him that. And the destruction of the black family as a result of these failed liberal government policies is why we had Ferguson, Missouri, where people can't find meaningful work. They live in generational poverty, and their kids have to attend failing schools. That's what we need to fix. We do not need to transform, as the president said, American policing. American policing is fine. The president said American police officers are badly trained. We have some of the best law enforcement training in the world. We have our own case going on in Milwaukee, and I'm not going to go into that, but I will say this about it. I read the district attorney's opinion where a white police officer who shot a black male, as the black male was beating the officer with his nightstick, with the officer's nightstick that he took from him. And if you read the decision, and you apply it under the rule of law standard, you could not come to any other conclusion than that was a justifiable use of force. Okay, so I've made it clear. Why? Because our law enforcement officer, your community's finest, they don't have a voice. And when Bill de Blasio threw him under the bus and labeled the NYPD racist, and I went to the funeral of Officer Liu, and I met the widow of Officer Ramos at that wake, and I shook the hand of the father of Officer Liu, and he wouldn't let my hand go. So grateful that I came out to honor his son. Very broken English. And as I moved down the family line, I got to his mom, who stood up and hugged me. His mom didn't know me. I don't even wear the same uniform that her son does, but I'll tell you what she recognized. Fellow officer. She doesn't know anything about rank. She doesn't need to. I was there to honor her son's service that he paid for with his life. So I look at that stuff. They don't have a voice. as these officers are being slandered by some very important people in the United States, because when the president speaks and the attorney general of the United States speak, people listen, and they got to choose their words carefully, and they know it. And there was a lot of code language in what they were saying. They have to be unambiguous when they speak, and every American has to hear those two men and feel they're talking to me, and they weren't. They were talking to certain constituencies. So I decided to be that voice. I don't speak for every officer in America. I don't speak for any law enforcement agency. But I speak for the profession, because I've done it for 37 years. And I watch every day. I send out law enforcement officers every day, not knowing whether they're going to come back. And 2 years ago, I had to bury one of my own. And I've been to that law enforcement officers memorial in Washington, D.C., and I've looked at the names of over 20,000 peace officers who've sacrificed their lives. And I meet with the COPS, the Concerns of Police Survivors group, that comes into Wisconsin every year to attend a camp of widows, widowers, and children left without fathers and mothers. And I listen to their stories. That's whose side I'm on. That's whose side I will continue to be on. But I need your help. I know that we in law enforcement have the overwhelming support of people in our communities, but you're too silent. I recently cut a 30-second ad in Milwaukee on the radio with a message, talked about how our law enforcement officers are under siege and they need your help. And at the end I say, next time you see a law enforcement officer, go up and thank them for their service to their community. And I said, because they need that right now. And they do, because this is a tipping point. Because officers are starting to wonder, is this even worth it anymore? And that's going to be dangerous for you. So keep that in mind in your own communities. I know some of you came from out of states, neighboring states. I'm humbled by that. My heart's in the right place. It's going to stay in the right place. But we need your help. I took more time than I was supposed to, but you know what? Too bad. The fact that some of you came here, drove a long distance, I wanted to make it worth your while. Okay? So I guess now we'll take a few questions. I know I was supposed to leave 15 minutes. I talked into most of that, but we'll take as many as we can.
Sheriff Clark, thank you for coming.
Sure.
You've used the phrase, a chip on the shoulder, several times tonight. I think that goes to the heart of the issue. Everybody in this room has a chip on their shoulder. It seems like everybody in our country has a chip on their shoulder. How do we get back or get up to the point where tolerance of others and respect for the individual are paramount in our society?
It's got to start in the homes. It has to. There's a African proverb, and it says, the ruin of a nation begins in the homes of its people, and it's very true. This great nation is resilient. We'll survive this. I know many of you are frustrated. I talked to you tonight about the direction of our country. There were people that felt like that before the Revolutionary War. There were people that felt like that before the Civil War. We survived. And we'll survive this. But we have to, at least in the black community, rebuild a family. How do we do that? It's not like it's easy. But one way is to reel in these failed liberal government policies that make people dependent on government instead of dependent on themselves. So then we got to look to our political class, right? to play a role in that. We get the political leadership we deserve. But I'd start there. There's got to be a role for the church in this. There has to be. We've lost our way. God has been marginalized. Religion has been marginalized and ostracized. That's why we're failing as a nation.
There's an article on the internet that says that George Soros pumped $33 million into the Ferguson riots. I was wondering if you knew anything about that, and why don't they charge George Soros instead of General Petraeus?
Yeah, I don't know about, you know, obviously this anarchist movement is funded from outside sources. I've heard George Soros, I've heard numbers thrown around. It's beside the point, as far as I'm concerned, these are your communities. And what I saw happen in Boston this morning, they tried to do it in my county when 100 of these anarchists descended on the busiest freeway section in the state of Wisconsin, I-94, at rush hour. 74 of them went to jail. The other 26 saw the light and got away. Many of them were interviewed after this situation and said, "We didn't know we were going to get arrested." And I said, "Really?" Because I made it clear, you have to draw a bright line and you can't let people cross it. This is not a protest movement. It is not grounded in the First Amendment. This is not peaceful. This movement is anti-capitalist. It is anti-free markets. And they're trying to destabilize institutions in the United States of America and insert it with a socialist agenda. I identified this from day one. And now the mask is starting to come off, because when you take over the Mall of America and you start taking over freeway systems where commerce can't go on, they are now infringing on your rights to those public spaces to get from point A to point B, and for you as business owners to engage in the exchange of goods and services with the public, and for you as the public to go out and get those services that you're looking for. And you haven't done anything to Mike Brown. You didn't do anything to Eric Garner. That's why early on I said this isn't a civil rights movement. These are anarchists who've hijacked this tragedy. So I think the police have been a little soft, and I have been asking my colleagues, law enforcement executives, cops are just under orders, to be more assertive, because this group, you cannot appease them, and too many cities are trying to appease them. Well, just let them march a little. Just no. Because I go, what about your rights to use that freeway system? What about your right to use that retail area? I'm on your side. And the more you give to this group, the more they take. So I wasn't fooled by it. And now the police, I got a tiger by the tail now, because they're going to have to start to crack down. And probably a little harder now after letting them get away with it for so long. I didn't in my county. I just drew the line, said, here's where it is, and if you cross it, you're going to jail. All right, what happened in Boston this morning, I would have all those people arrested and charged with a felony. State of Wisconsin, it's recklessly endangering safety, a felony. And I would push the district attorney to charge them with a felony, and I would push to have no plea bargains. Because my attitude is, okay, if you came into this to leave a convicted felon, I will accommodate you.
A couple more questions, we could. Please.
Yes, I'd like to thank you for bringing to the public's attention that the war on police is headed by Marxist socialists, and that you've done a lot tonight to straighten some people out to what the real enemy is. I thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to serve.
Well, thank you for your service. I've seen you on Fox News, and I love to watch you.
Thank you.
But I think that part of the problem is that if we taught history the way history was actually played out, that all communities would find that there are plenty of role models to follow after. But also I feel that somebody in all communities have to stand up and say, we're not going to take it anymore, and you have to be the role model. You have to be the person that stands up and takes back your neighborhood and says, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Pull up your pants, take off your earrings, get a haircut, and be a man. Be a man. And if you don't have a role model, there's plenty of mentors out there. So my cousin's a mentor in the prosecutor's office. He's a wonderful human being. But I just think that you have to quit being afraid. You have to stop being afraid. Don't let anybody take anything of yours that you work very hard for. You have people like this, and the police are not to be feared. We have enough dead bodies to fill the morgues and the cemeteries. We have enough mothers that cry. We don't need it. We don't need to see it. Stand up and make a difference.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the history. People have been separated from their history. And that's part of the problem. And the first step, I think, toward restoring this thing that we call a republic, a constitutional republic, is to reconnect people with their history. Any dictator who was taking over a country started with two things. You control the media. You separate people from their history. Why do you think when Hitler went at the Jews, destroyed all of any remnant of the Jewish culture, separate them from their history? What do you think slavery was about and why it was able to thrive for so long? Because they separated black people from their history. And I've just found that when you reconnect people with their history, we don't have time tonight, but many of you may know that I took up the cause of the Second Amendment. A couple of years ago. And as I went back and reconnected with the history of the Second Amendment, you know what I discovered? The Second Amendment played a vital role in the freeing of the slaves. And it wasn't the 13th Amendment, although the 13th Amendment ended indentured servitude, slavery. But it was the 14th Amendment where the court said all of these rights and privileges in the United States apply to black people, and that included the Second Amendment. You know why the Second Amendment was vital? It was the only way blacks could protect themselves from lynching and mobs. So as I started getting more and more back in, it was fascinating. And I came away thinking, most blacks in the United States, because I don't say all or every, at least I try not to, should be huge supporters of the Second Amendment, and they're not. You know why? They've been disconnected from their history. They knew the role that the firearm played in their freedom. Ida B. Wells said, a Winchester rifle should hang over the mantle in every black person's home in America. Because it's a symbol of freedom, not just for them, but for you, and you all know that, okay? But as you mentioned, history we've been disconnected from our history.
Sheriff Clark, we had a chance to talk a little bit earlier, and I did identify myself as chairman of the Pottawatomie County Republican Central Committee. Somebody identified you as a Democrat. I have several of my executive committee members here tonight, and just passed a note. And the note said, "Would you please ask the sheriff if he would run for president?" So I would invite you to Pottawatomie County. Council bless. We have our Lincoln Reagan Day dinner in May. Please accept this invitation to be our keynote speaker, and let's get this ball on the road. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You know, I'm humbled and flattered. I get a lot of that. I got to run for another office. No, I don't. The country's starved for leadership. That's what I hear when people say that. This was going so well until that came up. But I appreciate it. I really do. And if you want me to come out and talk, you're going to have to send correspondence to my office. Right, I get a lot of invitations. The fact that I'm here tonight means something, because I could have been somewhere else. People looked at me. Because from here, I go to Vegas this weekend to a gun manufacturer show. They want me to speak. And then I leave there, and the next day go to Washington, D.C., and I've been invited to the Sheriff's Association in the state of Ohio. And there are too many invitations coming in. So I got to be selective. And she's seen the look on people's faces when I was in New York and say, "Omaha, Nebraska." I said, "Yeah, Omaha, Nebraska. You know why? Because you guys are true Americans." And there's no pretentiousness here. I met a lot of people tonight. I didn't get a lot of, you know, chance to spend a lot of time outside of this building here, but I met Omaha, Nebraska, and it's you folks, and I love you.
Sheriff, can you take yes, one more? I'm sorry, folks. We just are going to take one more. Sheriff Clark, I don't know if you'll be here after or not to talk to people, but if he is, you know, you can ask him. I'm not trying to throw you under the bus there, Sheriff, even though I just did. Sorry about that. That's one, folks.
Well, that was a great windup. I appreciate your being here. I have a question about the Ferguson thing, because there's something that has always puzzled me about that, and I'm wondering if you could lend some light on it. Why would a person, after robbing a store and having every reason to believe that was caught on surveillance cameras, then go out and walk around prominently in the middle of a street? That behavior has always seemed very, very weird to me, and suggests that this young man was maybe even trying to provoke some kind of confrontation. Does that make any sense to you as a law enforcement officer?
No, and we see it all the time. The case in Milwaukee, Dontre Hamilton, that I talked about, who took an officer's nightstick and started beating him with it, forcing the officer to use deadly force to save his own life. You're right. Don't try to make sense out of this. Many of these individuals, they're not thinking. They just react to circumstances. Mike Brown didn't see a uniform that day. He saw a guy that was in his way, and he's always pushed his way around in life like he was doing in that store. He's done it at home. He's probably done it in schools with his teachers. He's probably done it on the street with the guys he hangs out with. He's a good-sized guy, so he can get away with it. It's a phenomenon that, forget about trying to apply logic to it. It's illogical. Unfortunate. But it happens a lot, unfortunately. And I'm not talking about officers using force. I'm just talking about this behavior, because you use that word. This intolerable behavior displayed by too many young people who are in some difficult circumstances. When you grow up without a dad, it's going to be very difficult. It's not impossible. The young man tonight here, dad died in combat, I believe, right?
Correct.
All right. But I see he's got a support system that Mike Brown didn't have, and Eric Garner didn't have, and Dontre Hamilton didn't have. A family, when I say support system, they took it upon themselves to raise that young man under those difficult circumstances. I get that. People can overcome it. But everyone that Mike Brown pushed around, everybody just got out of his way. Officer Darren Wilson was not getting out of his way. As a law enforcement officer, those of you in here that are serving in your communities, you know this. We have to win. Why? The guardians of law and order. Who else is going to do it? You want Mike Brown running things? Or do you want the Ferguson Police Department being that firewall between law and order and chaos? That's why we have to win. And we're going to win. Yeah, sometimes officers get killed in the line of duty. That doesn't mean they lost. It's an honorable death, just like our soldiers. It's an honorable death defending freedom, defending your country, serving your community. There's a parallel here, which is what I liked when I was first approached about coming here. I said, soldiers and cops. Wow. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's late. I appreciate it, really. This has been wonderful. Hang in there, okay? We're gonna survive.
Thanks, sir.
God bless you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the keynote address from the Protectors of Freedom Rally, presented by Patriotic Productions, an Omaha nonprofit that has sponsored the honor flights to Washington, D.C., for veterans of World War II and Korea. The featured speaker has been the Sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, David Clark. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 15, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Bill Williams, co-founder of Patriotic Productions, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.